Welcome to Gender Reveal, a podcast where we hopefully get a little bit closer to understanding what the hell gender is. I'm your host and resident gender detective, Tuck Woodstock. Hey, everyone. Hope you've all been hanging in there. I'd love to have something eloquent or encouraging to say, but it's just been a really heavy, shitty week, huh? Well, a little backstory about today's short episode. Ozzy and I had originally prepared a normal, full-length episode for this week that included a full guest interview alongside an extended This Week in Gender segment about Cecilia. But on Saturday night, Ozzy and I received some news that ultimately meant we were going to have to, like, remake a bunch of the interview portion of the podcast. And we both decided that ultimately we were too sad and tired to tackle that at the last minute on a Sunday. So we are holding that interview for now. Hopefully we'll air it later this season. But we still do want to share our tribute that we put together for Cecilia Gentile. Had I known that the segment was going to be the entire episode, maybe I would have tried to build it out a little more, but it is what it is. And I am really, really trying to remember that the solution to grief is not to do more work and little projects about it, which is really hard, by the way, because, like, what's the alternative? Be sad? Feel my feelings? I guess. Anyway, thank you for being here to slow down and feel some feelings with me. It means a lot. Please take care of yourself, take care of each other, maybe text someone that you love them right now. Are you doing it? You did it? Okay. Well, it's time for This Week in Gender. As you know, we end every episode of Gender Reveal with the same question. In your ideal world, what would the future of gender look like? I never got to ask Cecilia Gentile what her ideal trans future was, and I want to say that it's because I thought there would be more time. And I did think that. Even though I am always thinking about death, even though my last several therapy sessions have been about how everyone just keeps dying, I still thought there would be more time because I have never in my life seen anyone more alive than Cecilia Gentile. As Peppermint wrote on Instagram, Cecilia was one of those women that I foolishly assumed and perhaps optimistically hoped that she'd sort of always be around. So, I did think there would be more time, but honestly, I also felt like I didn't deserve to ask for her time. She had accomplished so much, and I'll talk about that more in a few minutes, but it was more than that. It was that she loved so many of my friends and community members so much. She was a mother or the mother of half the trans girls of New York. She was, by all accounts, one of the most generous and supportive people that any of us had ever met. Chiquitita, who you know from the show, was one of Cecilia's cherished daughters. And after she passed, Chiqui wrote, quote, Cecilia Gentile is the first woman in my life to embrace every inch of me unconditionally. I need to say this. I have never in my life felt this way. People keep telling me how much she loves me and how highly she spoke of me. I still can't believe it's true. Even alive, I couldn't believe it. And Fran Tirado, who you also know from the show, wrote, quote, there isn't much I can really write to help you understand what this world will mean now without Cecilia Gentile. The times I've tried to describe my relationship to Cecilia, beyond that of a co-organizer, a creative collaborator, a colleague at a few nonprofits, a sister in mutual aid, a mentor, a trusted advisor, a muse for a short film we were producing, a figurehead for a doll party we now do every year. I would say, that's my mother. That's mom. Saying that now feels wrong somehow, like I'm not worthy enough to claim it, but it was true, still is true. More than anything, she saw me and loved me and made sure that I felt that love. For countless girls, not just me, she was my mother. We were all her kids. I'm not going to speculate where this seemingly common feeling of unworthiness or disbelief is coming from in others. I'm not going to unpack why I felt unworthy of even asking her for an hour of her time. But unfortunately, regrettably, I did. And honestly, I still feel like someone more worthy should really be writing this. which is why you're hearing me quote other people so much. But I have to remember that this is just one of thousands of tributes to Cecilia that do exist and will exist, so this is mine for now. As I was saying, I never asked Cecilia her ideal future of gender, but luckily, Raquel Willis did for her podcast, Afterlives, the Layleen Polanco story.
And what is the trans future you dream of?
I dream of a future of trans people being safe. I dream of a future where trans people may not be fully understood. And that is fine. I want people to say, like, I don't understand your transness, but I respect it. And I encourage you to live it to the fullest and to live happily. I cannot lose faith in humanity because otherwise it would be nothing for me to live for. Mm-hmm. I live in one of the most conservative parts of Brooklyn. I'm 2 blocks from the water. It's just beautiful, but it's very conservative, right? So mm-hmm. I know that it's people who are transphobic in my blog. And I always think of, like, I go to a supermarket and I touch my fruits and I smell my fruits and things like that. And I'm like, I'm going to leave this avocado here. And I just wish that someone who is transphobic comes and pick it and make a nice guacamole so they could see that we share an avocado experience and that nothing happened to them. And that me touching the avocado didn't make it worse or better. It kept it a fucking avocado. So with that, what I'm trying to symbolize always is like my existence really doesn't affect anybody.
I love it. And now I want an avocado.
Oh, God. Yes.
I realize that at this point we're several minutes in and I have yet to explain who Cecilia Gentile is. And that's because I assume you already know. And also because I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to adequately sum her up. She was an asylum seeker from Argentina who spent her life advocating for sex workers, undocumented immigrants, and queer and trans people. She was instrumental in getting the Walking While Trans ban repealed in New York. She co-created a free healthcare program for sex workers at Callan Lord, aka the Gay Hospital. The program is named after her. And for many New York trans people, she was the first and most significant support person for their medical transition. Cecilia wrote a memoir called Faltas, published by our friends Kat and Casey at Little Puss Press. She played Ms. Orlando on Pose, that's fun. She consistently, passionately spoke up for Palestine in her last few months and was brave enough to be arrested at a JVP action in October despite all of her previous fucked up experiences with the police. I remember watching the videos of her arrest and she managed to be like so joyful and triumphant even while being arrested. And it was so incredible and inspiring. She had a one-woman off-Broadway show called Red Ink. I had bought a truly unhinged amount of tickets to see it in April because no matter who my friends are or what their interests are, the one thing that everyone had in common is they all wanted to see Cecilia perform. There's so much more, but I don't feel like listing her accomplishments fully captures it. So instead, I wanted to read this description shared on Instagram by one of her closest friends and children, Sid Nova. Sid writes, quote, "Funny as hell, generous to a fault, loyal, principled, interesting, ferociously loving, gorgeous, committed, experienced, crazily smart, just a little bit crazy, brilliantly creative, sexy and horny as hell, an amazing cook, a good time out and about, a homemaker and sharer, a community creator, a princess, a tidy ass bitch, a visionary, a gangster, a forest nymph, a worldly woman. And I forgot the biggest whore in the entire world." That was originally a text that Sid sent to Cecilia on her 52nd birthday last month. Although Cecilia would definitely tell you that it was her 25th birthday, actually. Cecilia responded to Sid's text with, "Who that? Please introduce me with them. They sound amazing." And if you are listening to this and thinking, "Who that? They sound amazing," I encourage you to read Faltas if you haven't. I encourage you to listen to the Latino USA episode, Cecilia Gentile's Revolutionary Ask, and also to Raquel's podcast, Afterlives, which includes a bonus episode filled with Cecilia's stories. You can also listen to Emmy O'Brien's almost 3-hour long oral history with Cecilia, which was recorded in 2017 for the NYC Trans Oral History Project. There's also a full transcript online. I will link to all of these in the show notes, by the way. I have also been collecting tributes, photos, and videos of Cecilia in an Instagram stories collection, which is such a silly place to grieve, but that's where we're at. And I really do encourage you to watch as many videos as possible. Each one is such a gift. She's just so fucking funny, and also so strong and smart and brave and kind and good and hot, and nobody knows what to do without her. The last time I saw Cecilia was 4 days before she died. She was at the front row of Cheeky's Olympics of Drag show, and there are videos online of the part at the beginning of the show where Cheeky pulled Cecilia up on stage to celebrate her and do some silly little bits together. But I was late to the show, and I didn't see that part. And I also didn't see the part of the show where people in the front row apparently had to throw bologna in the queen's bras. But my friend Connor was there, and after Cecilia died, he texted me, "Cannot remember if she threw the bologna in the bras or was just near the people who did, but would like to think that she did." And ever since then, I keep making this little joke to myself, which is, just as we must imagine Sisyphus happy, we must imagine Cecilia throwing the bologna into the bras at the Olympics of Drag. But you know what? I do. I do imagine that, and I believe that it happened, and it brings me a lot of peace for some reason. And speaking of, nothing has brought me more peace than a snippet of conversation that I heard between Raquel and Cecilia. It was also recorded as part of the Afterlives podcast and reshared after Cecilia's death. And hearing it was the first moment that made me feel like, okay, somehow, all together, we're going to make it through this. So I would like to leave you with this clip for now.
And how do young trans people inspire you?
Oh, I live for them. I live for them. I'm an elder, but I'm in a consistent, intentional effort to look and feel young and relevant. So, yeah, I am an elder, but you may see me dressing like BTS, right? In an effort to kind of like feel relevant and cool, right?
I got you.
But it is because, like, you know, trans kids are so amazing. Like, you know, my children are beautiful. Like, you know, Gogo Graham, Gia Love, Rio, you know, those are my kids, and they're doing amazing things, and they're always teaching me. They keep me young because they're always pushing the envelope. And that's so inspiring, right? And it's also, I've been getting lately a sense, a peaceful sense of like, I can retire, you know? They're great. They got this. They should be able to do it. They don't need me. So I'm inspired by youth. I'm inspired by all of them.
I love it. I love it.
This has been This Week in Gender. That's going to do it for this week's show. We will be back next week with another full episode. In the meantime, we are on Instagram at Gender Reveal, where we have a story collection going of different clips and photos and tributes to Cecilia. If you aren't familiar with Cecilia and her work, I really encourage you to watch those videos and any others that you can find, and also to check out the many, many, many other interviews and stories and books and videos linked in the show notes. This episode was produced and edited by Ozzie Linus Goodman and by me, Tuck Woodstock. Special thanks to Raquel Willis and Dylan Hoyer at Afterlives Podcast for being so, so, so helpful in letting us use that tape of Cecilia. Thank you also to Cheeky and Sid and Fran and Peppermint and everyone else for sharing those beautiful tributes to Cecilia publicly. Our logo is by Ira MY. Our theme song is by Breakmaster Cylinder. And there's additional music this week by our friends at Blue Dot Sessions. We'll be back next week with more feelings about gender. Free Palestine. One time back in 2020, when I was reporting on this protest, my mom started getting calls for me at her workplace, which was freaky and horrible. And I assume that it happened because there are websites out there who keep track of not just our names and addresses and phone numbers, but the contact information of our family and roommates. And it's so weird and bad, but Delete Me can help. Delete Me removes private information from more than 750 data broker sites. It's super quick and easy to set up. Just go to joindeleteme.com/genderreveal to learn more and get 20% off your first year. That's joindeleteme.com/genderreveal. Welcome to Gender Reveal, a podcast where we hopefully get a little bit closer to understanding what the hell gender is. I'm your host and resident gender detective, Chuck Woodstock. Hey everyone. Hope you're all hanging in there. This week on the show, I am very excited to share my chat with Honey Mahogany. You might recognize Honey from Drag Race Season 5, which was 10 years ago. But Honey is a true multi-hyphenate. She's a social worker, an activist, a performer, a politician, a small business owner, a musician. I could just go on and on. And in this episode, we talk about everything from being one of the first official drag queen story hour queens to co-founding the world's first trans cultural district to buying a queer bar with 17 other community members.
It was a lot of planning and a lot of processing, and a lot of talking. And, you know, it was like probably like 20 hours a week of processing.
But before we get to that, just a reminder, this is your last week to grab merch out of our merch shop for the foreseeable future. You can view everything in the shop, all sorts of new designs and restocks at bit.ly/gendermerch. Also, a reminder, we are not putting out a new episode next week because we need to record more episodes first. Very understandably, no one has been available to do interviews during Pride, nor would I expect them to. So we're taking a week or two off to regroup, but we will be back soon. And now, it's time for This Week in Gender. Okay, this week in gender, we actually have a nice political news item for once. Ozzy's going to tell you about that. But first, I just wanted to address something quick about last week's show. We did a spicy advicey, and there was one question in particular where I had been like, I don't know if that's clear, but I think we'll just roll with it. And the answer, according to at least one Instagram comment, was that it was not clear at all. So I listened back and was like, oh no, that was a mess. Why did you wear that? And that's what I get for flying too close to the spicy sun. But anyway, someone asked a question last week about whether it's a privilege to be read as your assigned gender at birth as a trans person. And I was like, I don't give a shit about litigating what is and is not a privilege. That does not feel useful. And my internal thought process when I was saying that was that there are very obvious large structural privileges that hopefully we can all agree on, like whether or not someone experiences anti-Blackness, racism, misogyny, transmisogyny, misogynoir, et cetera, et cetera. And then there are these like very niche air quote privilege questions like, is it a privilege to be misgendered in the supermarket? I don't know. If you're on Twitter, I feel like you're very used to this kind of shit because someone will say like, I love riding my bike, or I enjoy relaxing with my husband in the garden. And people will like absolutely lose their minds being like, it is a privilege to be able to ride a bike. It is a privilege to have a husband or a garden. And that's where my brain was. So when I say I don't want to litigate what privilege is because it's not useful, what I was actually referring to is like, I don't want to decide whether like bikes are a privilege or gardens or whether being called ma'am by the barista is a privilege or whether trans women are more or less privileged than non-binary people, which anyway, that's all stuff that people talk about. And the reason I don't want to do that is because I have seen that kind of stuff be flattened of all nuance and then used to completely ignore other extremely real axes of privilege. And I don't want to create more ammunition for example, transmasculine people to claim that they're less privileged than trans women, or for white trans people to create elaborate scenarios in which they are somehow less privileged than Black trans people and other trans people of color. So that's what I was thinking. And instead, I basically just said, I don't believe in privilege, which is like absolutely unhinged and incorrect. I am sorry for not catching in the edit that I was not being clear, that I was specifically referring to sort of like Twitter brain, woke mind virus version of privilege. And of course, like, you're still welcome to disagree with my take, but it just was really bothering me for the entire week that I really wanted to clarify that it was not a like racial privilege doesn't exist take. Okay, I am now going to pass the mic over to Ozzy for our real, actual This Week in Gender.
So last week, there were two major victories for trans people in the hellscape, sometimes known as the United States. First, on Tuesday, June 20th, a federal judge ruled that Arkansas can't ban gender-affirming healthcare for trans kids, which is great. It means that starting right away, the state can't enforce its trans healthcare ban. This is the first major ruling in the country on healthcare for trans kids. Arkansas was the first state to ban gender-affirming care for kids in 2021, so this is the first lawsuit that's had a chance to finish making its way through the courts. There have previously been judges in other states who have paused similar laws, but they haven't made any final decisions. So because this Arkansas ruling is final, it basically means it's more likely to have an impact on the way other judges in the state look at similar laws. In other good news, on Wednesday, June 21st, a federal judge ruled that Florida can't ban Medicaid coverage for gender-affirming care. This is super important for the estimated almost 10,000 trans people in Florida who use Medicaid. This decision should also have an immediate effect, as trans Floridians on Medicaid can once again use their insurance to pay for care. So both of these rulings are great news, but even now they're not actually set in stone. The Arkansas Attorney General has already said they're going to appeal this ruling. And since Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is running for president, it seems pretty likely he'll try to keep this legal fight going for media attention, if nothing else. That's scary because an appeals court could reverse either of these decisions. On the other hand, let's say the appeals court agrees with the judge in Arkansas, then that ruling would apply to a bunch more states: Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota. And if the appeals court agrees with the judge in Florida, then that ruling will also apply to Alabama and Georgia. By the way, no matter what the appeals courts say, the fight over trans healthcare is almost certainly going to make it to the Supreme Court eventually, which, like, doesn't feel great considering this is almost the exact same Supreme Court that gutted abortion rights last year. So, you know, if anyone has any ideas for how we could make sure there are different people on the Supreme Court by the time they rule on this, now would be, like, a great time to put those into action. For legal reasons, that is a joke. This has been This Week in Gender.
We've got a They Mail message for you today. They Mails are, of course, little messages from listeners. You can sign up for your own They Mail using the form in the show notes. Today's message is from M, and it says, listen to M's crispy, spicy, and extremely trans experimental pop album, New Me, on the Celestial Jukebox at linktree.com/m_lore. Mention gender reveal, and M will send you the song stems to remix, mash up, and set free on the dance floor. Again, that's linktree.com/m_lore for your bad NB anthem needs. linktr.ee/m_lore. Honey Mahogany is a social worker, activist, and politician based in San Francisco. She is the founder of the Transgender Cultural District, a co-owner of San Francisco's infamous Stud Bar, and currently serves as the chair of the San Francisco Democratic Party. The way we always start the show is by asking, in terms of gender, how do you describe yourself?
I describe myself as a trans femme, I guess. I'll respond to woman. I'll respond to trans. Yeah, somewhere on that spectrum.
Yeah. We'll circle back to gender, but I wanted to ask, you've held so many jobs and titles and community roles, and I'd love to have more of an idea, like, what your just, like, day-to-day is like. What's going on with you right now?
My day-to-day is pretty crazy. I'm one of those people who I feel like I must be happy when I'm busy because I'm always busy. Either that, or I feel like we as queer and trans people, I think this is also true for, like, Black women in particular. Society puts out such negative images and expectations of us that we oftentimes feel like we have to overcompensate. I mean, within the Black community, there's always that adage, you have to work like twice as hard to get half as much. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe this is how we process our trauma, right? Mm-hmm. By keeping ourselves super busy and being super productive and, you know, feeling like we have to constantly be proving ourselves. That being said, when I'm not doing a million things at once, I feel like I get depressed. And yeah. So it's probably my way of coping, and I probably should go to therapy and be okay with just existing. But so far, these coping methods seem to be, I don't know, working for me, and I seem to be getting some joy from them. So all that to lead into, what does my day look like?
Wait, first, I want to talk about this, though, because I'm so glad that you had, like, a real thoughtful explanation, because I was going to be like, are you a Capricorn? Which is, like, useless. So I don't know.
But wait, I am are a Capricorn. You a Capricorn?
Okay,
yes.
Okay, but then also you are a Capricorn. So, okay, beautiful. Anyway, deeply relate. We were on a season break between episodes or seasons of the podcast, and instead of, like, resting, I made an 150-page anthology book that I'm now still finishing. So I deeply relate to this. Like, I cannot chill for even 1 second. So anyway, what's your day-to-day like?
Usually I wake up to a barrage of text messages from work. I work in politics and government, and that is a job that is basically 24/7. Mm-hmm. I work for elected Matt Haney, and, you know, he's so busy working most of the time that the time that he has to process or, you know, think about things and reflect on things is usually in the evenings, in the wee hours of the morning, and that's when we get our text messages. And so I have set a boundary for myself not to respond at, like, 5 a.m.
Good.
But, like, yeah, so I usually, like, wake up, have a sip of coffee, look at my phone, think about how I'm going to respond, and then respond in the morning to my sort of morning text messages of, this is what we need to look into. We should do this next. Why aren't we doing this? And then, you know, my 9-to-5 job is working as the district director for Assemblymember Haney. So that's my 9-to-5. And then usually in the late afternoon, sometimes in the morning before I go into work, I will have political meetings because I'm also chair of the San Francisco Democratic Party. So I'm also meeting with constituents, with union leaders, organizers, to talk about resolutions to introduce at the party. And then usually at some point there is either a meeting related to the Stud, which I'm a co-owner of, on Mondays, or if it's a Tuesday or a Thursday, I have band practice with my band's commando. And oftentimes these days, especially this month, we're recording this in June, it's Pride Month. And mm-hmm. So almost every other night there is some sort of event to go to, speak at. So yeah, that is kind of what my typical day looks like.
Beautiful. Well, now that we've laid out all the things that you do, I can't wait to just ask you about them all individually for the rest of the thing, because there's so many things to circle back to. It's hard to know where to start. But I actually wanted to start by asking you about your name, because it's the name that you use as a drag queen, but also the name you use to run for office, which feels rare, right? Is there a journey where this started as a drag name and became a legal name, or was this always the name used for everything?
Well, it was definitely not the name that my parents gave me. When people use the term dead name, I totally get it. And also, like, I don't feel that way about my name.
Totally.
That I was given at birth. Like, my parents named me Alpha, which is, like, I don't know, it was always weird growing up. Like, every time I would meet someone, it was like a thing, like a joke or a comment or whatever. So I guess I'm used to having unusual names. Honey Mahogany came about because basically when I was in high school, I was doing musical theater, like all little queers do. And they had us buy our own makeup, like for the show. And I went into Walgreens and went to the Revlon section, and the two shades that were closest to my skin color were honey and mahogany. And I didn't think of it then, but later on, I think when I started doing drag, folks were like, you have to find a drag name. And that whole, like, your first pet and the street that you grew up on thing, I was totally. Like, it would have been Lullaby Taravel or Taravel. Like, I mean, you know, like I was like trying to like make it sound more fancy than it was Taravel. And so I just, that did not ring for me. But then I was looking at my makeup. I was like, honey, mahogany, that sounds good. So let's do that. And then, you know, I think with drag, there was always like this thing where your friends and fellow queens would just sort of always refer to you by your drag name.
Totally.
And so everyone was calling me honey all the time. And when I like began to socially transition, it was just like, do I have to have another name? Like, totally. I don't, like, I'm fine with honey. So this is how people know me. This is how I'm. And I also like, you know, drag is very linked to activism in our community, and not always, but can be. And because I was not just doing drag, but also doing activism as Honey Mahogany,
yeah,
it just made sense to sort of hang on to that name. And you know, I feel like Honey Mahogany. That's who I am.
Yeah.
I think also even the name Mahogany, I think that it's a very like black name to me also, which is important and empowering for me personally. And it's interesting. There was this woman who was a previous supervisor here in San Francisco and also served with me on the San Francisco Democratic County Central Committee. And when I first joined the party, she was like, you know, I had no idea who you are, but your name told me everything I needed to know about you. Mm. You are honey, you are mahogany, you are sweet, you are strong, you are powerful, and you know, you're exactly the kind of person we need in this space. And so, you know, I think that made me feel reaffirmed in, you know, keeping that name.
Yeah, beautiful. Since we're talking about drag a little bit, we love to ask people what their relationship is between drag and gender. And we just talked to someone a couple weeks ago for this show who told us that they didn't realize that they were trans until they were doing drag. And so I'm not to say that used to be your experience, but I'm curious what the sort of relationship is between gender and drag for you or has been.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's complicated for me because it could easily say that, oh, it was through doing drag that I discovered that I was trans. But I really think I did drag because I was trans.
Totally, yeah.
And didn't quite like come out and realize that I was trans until later. I feel like I always envisioned myself in my mind as a woman, as a mother, as a princess, as, you know, whatever, you know, like all these different roles that kids think about. But I always thought of myself filling those roles as a woman. And the way that I even got into drag was that a friend of mine who was a film student. So I went to the University of Southern California, mm-hmm. which has a really great big film program. And my friend was in that program and he asked me to be in his first student film, which turned out to be a coming out story of someone reintroducing themselves to their family, someone who was assigned male at birth, but then introduced their family to the female version of themselves. The movie was all about the like putting on of the drag, which is, you know, I know, like so overdone, but
it was another time.
It was a different time.
Yeah.
But it really was a part of, I think it was a foreshadowing for me in a lot of ways. It was how I got started in cross-dressing, right? And even that it was a performance. I think also later on when I was outed to my family, it was through pictures of me in drag. And so like this theme of like drag or whatever has always sort of been a gateway into who I am and has sort of been a part of each portion of my journey.
Yeah. Well, speaking of drag again, when we were doing research for this episode, tell me if I understood this correctly, were you in sort of the first iteration of Drag Queen Story Hour queens? Can you tell me about that? Because I think it is now such a obviously a hot button issue, but I didn't realize that it was such a recent invention as an event, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a complicated history there in that, you know, I think over a decade ago or more, there were a couple one-off things. Like, There was, I believe, a reading by one of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, actually, at a library with children. So, like, I don't think that, you know, Radar Productions or anyone really that I know of was the first to start Drag Queen Story Hour or doing drag queen, being a drag queen and reading to children. Mm-hmm. That being said, I think in terms of a formal sort of, we're going to do this and it's going to be a program that we do. Yeah. Drag Queen Story Hour, which was a program done with like Julien de l'Opera and Virgie Tovar and Michelle T.
Oh.
They all worked together and at that point and through Radar Productions and started doing this thing called Drag Queen Story Hour. I think the first Drag Queen Story Hour queen officially was Mother Chukka. And then I think I got involved also folks like Yves Saint Croissant and Persia. And then it sort of slowly started to expand. And we were doing things like, yes, we were doing readings in public libraries for with kids and their parents and their families, and it was really fun. We also did, I remember we did this like drag prom for young kids. It was like this sort of like come to a drag story hour event and kids can come dressed up at however they want to. And so there were these kids that came and dressed up and they were like, yeah, I really want to be a drag queen or I'm trans. And, you know, they were just so excited to like have the opportunity to be there and dress up and be affirmed and have fun and not have to be afraid of being made fun of or teased or anything like that. And it was really, really magical. That being said, we did have, I think, one protester that was outside, maybe two. And, you know, the parents, you know, obviously were there and they sort of blocked them out. That event ended up getting covered in the Chronicle. There was like a picture of me, I believe, that was put both on in the Chronicle, but also online, like on Facebook or something. And so one of the like top trending story for that day on Facebook was me doing Drag Queen Story Hour. And at that time, I remember like getting tagged in like videos by like right wing trolls being like, this Honey Mahogany is corrupting our children. And she didn't even get my name right. She kept calling me Honey Monogamy, which I'm like, Freudian slip.
That's incredible.
Which actually happens more often than you would think.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know why people want to say monogamy so much, but it is what it is. And so that's when really things started popping off. And I also think that that is what popularized Drag Story Hour. And then I saw like, you know, there were other folks who were doing it like because there was a demand. Yeah. Like people were asking for it. And so it really started to take off. But also, you know, I think it also made us a target. Oh, I should say Little Miss Hot Mess, obviously, like superstar queen and also wrote the book, right? The Heels on a Drag Queen. Or no, the Hips on the Drag Queen goes swish. So she wrote that book. And she was also one of the founding queens of Drag Story Hour as an official organization.
Yeah. I've gone to Drag Story Hour defenses before, and it can feel sort of wild that there will be like 20 of us on one side, 20 protesters on the other side, and there are like 3 kids in the building getting the story read to them. And I think there's sometimes a moment of like, why is all this happening? What is this for?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, like, when we did Drag Queen Story Hour here, I think the first one I did, there were probably like 30 kids. Many of them were very young. Some of them were like definitely too young to even understand what was going on. So it was definitely like also like a social thing for the parents that were fun. A lot of queer parents were like, ugh, I love going to drag shows and I can't anymore because I have this 6-month-old child. I'm so glad you're doing this. But also, like, there were definitely toddlers that would be there and like be curious and ask us questions. And, you know, like it was really fun and sweet and wonderful. And the kids did not really care. Like, I think I did get asked once by a kid, like, are those real? Referring to my chest. But it was so innocent. And then the next second it was like, you know, okay, I'm going to go like play with this like triangle, totally. You know, or whatever it
yeah,
was.
Absolutely.
It was just like, again, like for them, it's not a big deal because, I mean, kids live in first of all, they're still discovering their world. So they kind of take things at face value. Second of all, they are used to interacting with imaginary characters, right? I mean, Barney, yeah. Sesame Street, whatever, Teletubbies, whatever you want to point to, or even like The Little Mermaid. Like, these are fictional characters and they understand that there is everyday reality and then also like these magical worlds that they get to play in and that it's a part of imagination. And it is a safe space for them, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so this like reaction to drag is just really frustrating and sad, because I think that it is scaring people's families, like people's families who would otherwise be, I think, eager to go to a drag show for a variety of reasons, or drag story hour for a variety of reasons, now feel like it's an unsafe place for them, and also that they don't want to put their kids through that, right?
Yeah,
so,
totally.
Yeah, and I'm sure it is. Just like Target is sort of pulling stuff from its shelves, right? Because they're afraid for their employees or, you know, whatever it is, which I think is, you know, I understand that. You know, similarly, like, it's having an impact on people also attending drag story hour.
Right, because it becomes, like, a big political choice that you're making, rather than just like a fun activity that you're doing for your kids. You're like, do I want to run the gauntlet of like going through these protesters yelling terrible things at my kids, which is not what anyone should have to choose when they're going to a fun event at the library.
Yeah. Yeah. Number one, it's been made into a political choice, but it's also been made into a safety call.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what I mean by political choice is like, do I want to like live my politics and like show it to them, that be like, we won't let you have this. We won't let you make us scared, instead of just being like, have a good time. But
totally.
Anyway.
No, but I think you're right. I mean, it is it has become politicized. Something that should not have been politicized, was not inherently political, is now political. And then because of that is now also dangerous.
Right. I mean, and that's also true about being transgender. So let's talk about, you're a founder of the Trans Cultural District in San Francisco, the first ever trans cultural district in the world. What does that mean? What is a trans cultural district?
Well, let me just say that when we started the trans district, we were at a time in San Francisco where it was at the height of sort of the tech innovation, the second tech boom, right? And we were seeing rapid gentrification of many of our neighborhoods. I mean, San Francisco is a really interesting city in that it's, you know, it's 7x7. It's on three sides, we're surrounded by water. And then on the south side, we have immediately like Daly City, right? So there's no way for us to sort of expand or sprawl. We just have to build up. And historically, the way that we have done building in San Francisco has been demolishing poor Black and brown neighborhoods, you know, building a housing on top of it, you know, telling all those Black and brown people to move and get out, and then like replacing them with people that we want there, wealthier people, whatever. Right. And but the trans district was started because, you know, one of the last few affordable neighborhoods in the city was the Tenderloin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of queer history really traces its roots back to the Tenderloin, whether it be the fact that, you know, the Tenderloin was the original vice district of San Francisco, where things like sex work and during Prohibition, people could drink there and gamble there and do all these things there. And it, in many ways, that is still the case today. That history lives on. And I mean, even the fact that it's named the Tenderloin is because the city was, or the police were, you know, very blatantly taking advantage of businesses who were participating in illicit activities, and they would get a cut of the proceeds from those businesses and illicit activities. And the place where they could make the most money was this area in the heart of the city, which they named the Tenderloin, which is the juiciest cut of meat. Mm-hmm. So our history as trans people and as queer people, we've oftentimes been relegated to those spaces because we weren't accepted in polite society, right? I mean, there were public decency laws which prevented you from quote unquote cross-dressing, being seen in public. And so the only places that we could be ourselves were in these neighborhoods where there was less policing for whatever reason. So that's where a lot of our historic bars have existed, bathhouses, theaters, and then, of course, housing. And to this day, it's where probably the highest concentration of trans people live anywhere in the country, maybe the world. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, try spending a second walking down the Tenderloin and not seeing a trans person. I challenge you. And I will say, I live in the south of Market right now in San Francisco, and it is becoming more and more trans, which I find very, very exciting. And we have like a trans art gallery and another trans space that are opening in SoMa. So it's a really kind of a cool time right now, I think, even as the city is facing so many challenges, to see these things pop up. But going back to the trans district, we really wanted to prevent the erasure of that rich trans history. And so we really centered our advocacy around the remembrance of the Compton's Cafeteria riots, which happened in San Francisco in 1966, which we love to say was 3 years before Stonewall. Mm-hmm. And our vision was to have an area, a neighborhood where trans people were not just surviving, but also thriving, where we had decent housing and access to services, and had like affirming art and spaces, and that we could also own businesses in the neighborhoods that we lived in. So it was really about socioeconomic empowerment. And it has also been about, of course, anti-displacement.
Right.
And that we were consulted in sort of the further development of the neighborhood. And it wasn't about preventing like housing from being built or anything like that, but it was about making sure that we had seats at the table. You know, immediately after the Black Lives Matter movement, the narrative of the trans district really hit home for people, and people started donating. People who I think had said no so many times before were all of a sudden saying yes. And so the trans district was able to open up a physical space, to start a housing program where they provided rental subsidies for trans people to stay housed in San Francisco or get housed in San Francisco. They started an entrepreneurship program where they were and continue to train trans folks with business ideas on how to get their business started, and also give them seed money and grants to start businesses. Fluid Coffee is one that has been really successful. Harton Electrolysis is a trans-owned electrolysis center.
That's really cool.
You know, the woman behind it also is sponsoring other trans women to get their electrolysis license. It's just been so, so incredible to see the way in which that program, you know, continues to grow and pay stuff forward. And, you know, it is really like our dreams are becoming reality. The Trans District was also, I think, the first organization to provide basically like cash bailouts to residents during the pandemic. So like providing direct cash assistance for groceries or rent. I will say since then, you know, people's attention spans are really short. And
yes.
It was like, you know, 2 years after Black Lives Matter, it was all of a sudden like, oh, we don't have money anymore. Right. And mm-hmm. it became really hard for the trans districts to maintain some of its programs. And also, I think as a growing organization, like, you sort of realize where your expertise or your niche is, because there are a lot of other trans serving organizations in the city, and the trans district wasn't meant to be a catch-all for everything for trans people. And so it's let go of some of its social programs, except for the business one. But it is very much about creating cultural events and, again, you know, continuing to really help trans folks with business ideas. I will say, you know, it's been really disheartening for me personally that there have been some voices. And of course, it's usually like non-trans voices, like cis queer voices, who have accused the trans district of being established as a part of like a scheme to gentrify the Tenderloin, or as part of a, you know, I've been called like, I don't know, accused of like trying to gentrify the neighborhood. I was quoted, I think, in some Guardian article as saying like, you know, just because we are poor, just because we are trans, just because we are of color, does not mean that we can't have clean streets, safe streets, and decent housing. Like, I think that right. We deserve that. And so if that's what people think is gentrifying and want to accuse me of, like, you know, being a Trojan horse for, you know, developers, yeah. I guess that must be what I am. No, I don't think that that's what I am. But it's just, it has been really hard to see that, especially from people who say that they're standing up for trans folks, that, you know, instead of fighting the folks I think that we should be fighting, like these insane people who are trying to take away our rights, our healthcare, our existence, that they are, you know, determined to spread misinformation and attack the work of three Black trans women. I just think that's wild.
No, it's so wild. But that's what infighting is, right? Is like, people are like, well, if I take on the actual structural power that is causing the scenario, I will not win. So if I just like punch down on my community, and in fact, people who are more vulnerable than me in my community, maybe that'll make me feel something. It's just like, come on, guys.
Yeah.
Gosh, I'm so sorry that that is happening. So I was like, all right, we're going to talk. I will watch like an episode or two of season 5 of Drag Race just to kind of see if there's anything there. And something that made me, you know, screaming, crying, throwing up was that the second episode where Monica Beverly Hills comes out as trans is the same episode where you and Jinx, famously two trans femmes, have to lip sync to the song Tranny Chaser.
Oh.
And I was just like, what an iconic time in our society. So I was just wondering, like, obviously there were many trans femmes on that season, although, you know, they were not all out at the time. I was wondering if y'all ever talked about sort of gender behind the scenes, or if you kept it quiet because of the whole we could get kicked off, you know, thing, or any other reason.
Yeah, I don't think that I like was fully processing my gender like that at that time. Mm-hmm. I am very good at compartmentalizing, and also, I don't know, like when I need to. And I did that even with my queerness. Like, I was like, I know that this is a thing, but like, I'm just not going to think about it. And I didn't really think about it and openly process it until I was in college. I think similarly with my transness, that was a thing as well. And it was always like other people telling me that I was trans. Like, I remember my friend Jupiter would just be like, you know, honey, are you Picklin girl? And I'd be like, what are you talking about? And she was like, you know, Picklin, are you on the Moans? And I was like, no, I'm not trans. Or like, I remember very specifically being at a drag show and I was talking to someone and I was like getting out of drag and they were like, oh, you know, what's up, honey? And I was like, well, you know, things are a little hectic. I'm in transition right now, because I was transitioning between living in Berkeley and living in the city. And they were just like, oh, honey's transitioning. She's a woman now. She's finally come out. Like, it was like this whole, you know. And so there was a lot of that happening over the years. You know, I was always the like, oh, she's fish. Mm-hmm. She, you know, Peaches Christ famously does this sort of like annual Showgirls review where she like does a viewing of Showgirls and then does a theater version of it. And I was in this one, which was the Night of 1,000 Showgirls. And we actually did a film reel for it, like where we did the intro to the movie. And in that movie, I get cut from the cast of dancers. And her line to me is, too pretty, too real. And I don't know, we look back on that now and laugh because she's like, well, I guess you were too real, honey Mahogany. Yeah. See, I knew. I always knew. Yeah. So it was definitely one of those situations where I was just like, yeah, I guess this is true for me, you know? Yeah. And so I don't think Jinx and I talked about that specifically at that time, but we did talk about a lot of other things. And I will also say that like Tranny Chaser to me, I mean, I don't think you could sing that song now, but like, it was, yes, it was a read. It was also, I think, a lot of us felt like it was a little bit empowering.
Totally, yeah.
In that, like, yes, we're attractive and people want us. And it's also funny because I'm in this band now, Commando, which, you know, involves Lynn Breedlove from Tribe 8 and Homobiles. And they also had a song, I think, I don't remember if it was called Tranny Chaser, but it was about how they had a crush on RuPaul. And, like, Lenny and I have had all these processing sessions as well because he's talked about, like, how back in the day, like, as a trans man, he was sort of told, like, he wasn't supposed to, like, be attracted to trans women or drag queens, even though he felt like he was. And so, like, you know, there was just a way in which I think the queer women / trans men community was... And also, I think within I don't think it was understood. There wasn't as much tea for tea
right.
openly happening. And now there, I think it's almost like a thing. Like, my partner is trans also. I know so many trans folks who are in relationships with other trans people.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just think that's incredible.
It's so good.
Yeah.
All right. You are one of 18 owners of the Stud, or were when it's the 18 owners of the Stud. I don't know if they're still all involved. But it was the first cooperatively owned nightclub in the United States. And there's so much to talk about here with the history of the Stud, the future of the Stud. But what I wanted to ask was about your experience of buying a business collectively, because that's something that queer people, I think, talk about all the time, of being like, can we save this together as a community? I was just wondering like what that experience has been like, if there's tips or you would recommend it or anything like that.
I will say it was not easy.
Yeah, totally.
But I don't regret it. I think it was really, really a cool thing. And I feel it can be done. You know, I still have my dream of like one day buying a little ranch in the woods or something, totally. If they don't all burn down. And like owning it collectively with folks and, you know, having a little queer trans retreat. So I would do it again. So I feel like, yeah, it was a good thing. It was a lot of planning and a lot of processing and a lot of talking. And, you know, it was like probably like 6 to 7 months of like 20 hours a week of processing. And then finally buying the business and getting all the money together. And like that even was like took a long process because people had to like find the funds. And some people were quicker than others at getting them or getting them in on time or had to get them in late. And then we had to subsidize it. And some people gave more money than others. And we had to figure out a system for how those people were going to get paid back. And I mean, there's so much that goes into it. But at the end of the day, like, it worked. And even though the stud is closed now, like we're actively working on bringing it back. And it's not all the same people. We've had a little bit of attrition. I think we have like 2 less members now, but it has been a life-changing experience. And, you know, I do think it's the way for the future because, you know, how else are we going to compete with larger corporate interests, people with more money and wealth? We need to find ways to collectively take ownership of things if we want them to survive, especially things that cater to communities that are in the minority, right? It's not just LGBT, you know, Black businesses, you know, API businesses, whatever it might be. Like we are seeing sort of the disintegration, I think, of some of those businesses, right? I mean, over time, even before the pandemic, LGBT businesses and bars were closing like crazy all across the country. And I think a lot of that has to do with rising rents. It also has to do with, I think, queer people maybe feeling less like they have to go to queer bars or spaces and that they can just go anywhere now. But these spaces are still incredibly important to our community, both as sort of cultural hubs and also places that are willing to give us work. Because, I mean, the truth of the matter is that we still face discrimination.
Right.
And even if we didn't face discrimination, our parties are way better. They're more fun.
Also, right.
Like, we need to not let that die.
No, absolutely. Wow, so many thoughts on that. But instead, I'm going to ask you my last question. So the way we always end the show is by asking, in your ideal world, what would the future of gender look like?
I mean, in my ideal world, I feel like we'd get to a place where gender was not a big deal. I mean, I think gender expression should just be a part of a human being. And everyone is a human being first, whether you are masculine or feminine or somewhere in between. A society where we do not judge people based on their gender presentation, where we also don't judge people based on their sex assigned at birth, I think is a society where we're all safer, where our children are safer, and where we have the most potential to grow. So again, not saying that we should eliminate gender or that gender shouldn't exist. I think the diversity in gender is really, really special and adds so much spice and color to life. And I don't think that it should, you know, have an impact on what jobs you hold, what you're able to do with your body, or any of those things.
That's going to do it for this week's show. You can find Honey on Instagram at Honey Mahogany. You can find us at Gender Reveal and at genderpodcast.com, where we've got episode transcripts and all sorts of other resources. We're also, of course, on Patreon, where you can sign up for our weekly newsletter and our bonus podcast, Gender Conceal, as well as all sorts of other perks. And then don't forget about our merch shop. It is currently stocked with a bunch of new designs, and we will probably take another break from stocking the merch shop after this month. So grab what you want while you still can. That's at bit.ly/gendermerch. This episode was produced and edited by Ozzy Linus Goodman and by me, Tech Woodstock. Our logo is by Ira M. Lai. Our theme song is by Brickmaster Cylinder. Additional music this week by Blue Dot Sessions. We'll be back in a few weeks with more feelings about gender, but in the meantime, throw a brick at a cop.
Sometimes I end it with watching Real Housewives, I won't lie.
Beautiful. What's your favorite franchise?
That's like asking about a favorite child. I will say there is that child that I don't like as much, and that's Miami. Okay, right. So I do have favorites. I have Atlanta, Beverly Hills, New Jersey, Potomac. I'm starting to get and Salt Lake City.
Dun 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 dun. Okay.
I've got a dentist who's over 7 feet tall. Yes, I've got a dentist who's over 7 feet tall. Long John, they call him, and he answers every call. Well, I went to Long John's office and told him the pain was killing. Yes, I went to Long John's office and told him the pain was killing. He told me not to worry, that my cavity just needed filling. He said when I start drilling, I'll have to give you Novocaine. Yes, when I